KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Hours are expected.
My program will provide 100% retirement and free health insurance. I can do this because you are already paying for it with your payroll taxes.
Our economy is only going to get going again when we have a broad middle class that can become the consumers that drive businesses and build us going forward.
He was more famous than Bill Gates at one point, but he sort of disappeared into the mist, and he's sort of become background. That's why I say he's like Rainier. You know he's there, but we don't really go crazy.
Democratic Representative Adam Smith has represented his home district for the past 15 years. Due to redistricting, though, he is running in a different 9th district. It's now further north, no longer includes Tacoma. The new 9th district is also the first minority-majority district in Washington State for Congress. Representative Smith faces Republican challenger Jim Postma at the polls in November. Jim Postma ran in 2008 and is now running again. Jim Postma will join us on the phone in a little bit. He got stuck in traffic. Representative Smith is here now. Thank you for being here.
No, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the chance.
What is different about the 9th district? Who are the people you're representing now as opposed to before?
Well, first of all, the region's very interconnected. I mean, I said this from the first time I got elected, and I was looking at what was then the 9th district and saying, well, how do I do a good job of representing these constituents? How do they organize? What groups? What organizations? And what I found was, I mean, the whole region is so interconnected. You can't just represent Kent or Renton. It's very connected, frankly, from Everett to Olympia. So I think it has more similarities than differences, and that is, you know, you look at the economic drivers, Port of Seattle, Port of Tacoma, Microsoft, Boeing, University of Washington, the manufacturing base in the Kent Valley. All of that is very interconnected. So a lot of the issues that I've been working on as a congressman and as a state senator before that are connected. It's different in that it moved further north. Lost Thurston County, almost all of Pierce, and moved up into Seattle, Bellevue, and Newcastle.
Do you think that there are different people you're representing because of that that fact that it's a minority majority district, and will that change the way you're working? I'm sure you're going to tell me no.
Yeah, well, certainly it's a different group of people. But keep in mind, I grew up in SeaTac. I grew up in South King County, which is the most diverse area in the state right there. Now what I've added is Southeast Seattle and Bellevue, which are also very diverse. But look, my basis for getting into politics is very simple, economic opportunity. I grew up in a blue-collar family. I had opportunity because of the public education system, because of the union that my father belonged to, a whole host of reasons. And making sure that everybody's got a fair shot in our society is the reason I'm in politics. And certainly diverse communities, new communities of immigrants, they face challenges in those areas. The rest of us don't. But I'm going to stay focused on those issues.
What does that mean for the next term? What are the particular issues in terms of building and rebuilding this economy that you would focus on?
Well, the number one biggest issue is the budget. I mean, that's what we're all facing. We're in this sort of odd strategic pause here waiting up for the election. But, you know, we've got $4.5 trillion in tax cuts set to expire at the end of this year. We got a $1.2 trillion automatic across-the-board spending cut set to kick in on January 2nd. And we've got a massive deficit we have to deal with. How are we going to deal with that? And I think striking a balanced approach that protects some of those programs that I just mentioned, most notably education, infrastructure, the things that create opportunity for people from middle-class, blue-collar, working-class families versus what the Republicans are planning on doing, which is to cut taxes even further for the people making the most money in this country. And look, I don't support 90% top tax rates. I don't support back in the days when we had a 66% capital gains rate. But the tax rates that we had for wealthy people in the late 1990s both raised enough revenue and clearly created economic opportunity. If we're going to further cut those taxes, you are going to devastate the very programs that, you know, diverse communities, you know, communities in working class, blue collar neighbors are dependent on. Public education, infrastructure, things that fund innovation, and on and on.
What should the top tax rates be for the wealthy?
I like I said, late 1990s, it was 39.6. It seemed to work.
39.6 after what was the cutoff? Was that?
I think it was like it was a little over $300,000.
So would that be adequate again, or because of inflation, should it be lower?
I'd be happy to go back to that level.
What about capital gains? Where would you like to see the capital gains?
I don't mind keeping capital gains where they're at. We could take it. Now, where it was in 1990s was it was 20% for long-term, 28% for short-term. Now, keep in mind, I mean, Ronald Reagan wanted capital gains to be exactly the same as the top rate. That's why they moved them both to 28 back in the early 80s. And there's a certain wisdom to saying that income should be income regardless of its source. So I'd be willing to look at ways to modify that. But the other thing we need to do, forget about the rates. All the write-offs, all the deductions, all the complications in the tax code. It's to the point where the amount of taxes you pay has as much to do with how good an accountant you have as it does with what rate you should pay. And that, again, benefits people who make the most money. They know how to create those tax loopholes and take advantage of them. Right. Sorry, not create the loopholes, but take advantage of them, certainly.
Yeah, you guys create the loopholes.
Exactly.
All right, so all the tax rates. Mortgage deduction, should we look at that? For homeowners?
I don't think that that's necessary. Those are pretty basic middle class ones. It's when you get up into a lot of the, you know, a lot of it is very, very complicated in terms of write-offs for the, you know, for trusts and other things that you can do that creatively guard income. Ways to take income that ought to be income and call it capital gains, for instance. Those are things that we need to look at. But look, everything's on the table as far as I'm concerned. And if there's a way to modify the mortgage deduction that maybe brings in more revenue in a fair way, I'm not going to take that off the table.
Well, so if everything's on the table, and we hear that from many, many congressional leaders and members, why are we not able to come to, unless you want to blame it on lobbyists, why are we not able to come to something that would make a leaner and more efficient tax code?
I don't blame it on lobbyists at all. I blame it on the fact that we are deeply divided as a nation and deeply divided as a Congress as to how to do what I just described. As I mentioned, you know, the type of tax reform that I'm talking about, the Republicans want to cut taxes even further. Democrats want to bring back some of the revenue that we lost in the last 12 years of tax cuts. That's a deep division, getting a consensus on that. And then in terms of what programs you're going to cut. Those are things where we are deeply divided as a nation and deeply divided as a Congress, and that's why we can't get consensus right.
Well, is that short-term and long-term thinking, Adam Smith? I mean, would you support the idea of letting the tax cuts on the wealthy expire, figure out what to do about capital gains while you're trying to come up with that long-term solution for a leaner tax code?
Absolutely.
And what's the time frame, do you think, for that? I mean, how long does it take to do that?
We've got a whole series of hard choices here, but the number one biggest one is, so we get back in November 13th. We have until January 2nd to deal with the issues I just described, the expiring tax cuts and sequestration. Are we going to be able to come up with a big deal between November 13th and January 2nd? I don't know. And then
no.
The question is, do we kick the can down the road again? Do we say, okay, well, we'll extend everything for 6 months and then we'll try again? I don't know. At a certain point, it seems to me that we have to bite the bullet and make the decision. And maybe the best forcing mechanism is to say, all the tax cuts come back, sequestration kicks in. We don't like it. Let's fix it now in January.
Is there how much of the defense budget do you think could be cut?
I have no problem, first of all, with what the president proposed. He proposed reducing the defense budget by just short of $500 billion. Now, keep in mind, that was a reduction in the projected increase. So that number keeps us relatively flat for the next 10 years. And I think we can find more than that. 100, 200 billion. Having looked at it, I think there's clearly savings to be found. Look, the defense budget's 20%. Of the overall budget. It's 20% of a budget that's 40% out of whack. You know, reductions are going to have to be made.
How much would sequestration cut the defense budget by?
$54 billion in 2013. If you kept going over the course of the 10 years, it would cut it by another roughly 500.
Would that be damaging to our nation's security?
If we did sequestration, which is a mindless across-the-board cut, yes. Because you have to cut every single program by the same amount. Well, there are exceptions.
There's a few exceptions.
It's very confusing.
Veterans is accepted in some
ways. Yeah, veterans is personnel is accepted, but what does that mean? Look, just trying to figure out what it means is going to be damaging. But then, yes, if you do mindless across-the-board cuts to every single program, that would be damaging. If we were to reconstruct the budget and say, could we spend basically $1 trillion less over the course of the next 10 years than we had contemplated, I wouldn't completely rule it out.
That would be That would be if you had sequestration and tried to reconstruct it after January? Is that what you mean by
that? Yeah, or if we could do it before January, too. We could do it as part of a larger budget deal. Look, I mean, the projections that I'm going to get my years wrong here, but in the mid-80s, when we got to the point where we had concluded the Reagan defense buildup, around about 86, we had projections on what we were going to spend from roughly, I think, 85 to 95. That was reduced by $1.6 trillion from the mid-80s to the mid-90s. So a much bigger number than we're talking about here. And a lot of it also is, what are you spending it on? We had the debate in, the presidential debate last week. It's not just a matter of how many ships you have or what's the strategy? And how much are you getting your money's worth for what you're buying? And that we need to work on in the defense budget too.
More sabers, I believe, is what we learned. In 1991, Adam Smith was elected state senator representing the 33rd Legislative District. He held that seat for two terms. In 1996, he ran in the 9th Congressional District, and he's been representing that district since then. It has been remapped for this election. Jim Postma served in the Air Force, became a rocket scientist with North American Aviation, where he helped develop the Apollo moon rockets and the first ICBMs. He was a member of SPIA when he worked at Boeing. He's owned his own business, worked as an investment advisor, and served on his church council. Jim Postma got stuck in traffic, so he joins us by phone. Jim Postma, thanks for pulling off the road and talking to us. Jim, you there? No, he's gone. He not only got stuck in traffic, we lost him. All right, we'll try again in a minute. When you look at this campaign, not your campaign with Postman, but I guess that would work too. But when you look overall at this campaign, what issues have been effectively debated? I mean, has the economy been debated enough so that we understand our choices?
Yeah, I don't believe it has. As I kind of always joke, the one thing that both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama could say to each other and be absolutely correct about is, your math doesn't add up. Both are being, carving around the edges of the size of our deficit, what different programs would mean and how they would impact it. So look, in terms of what my priorities are, the issues we need to address, one is the budget that I talked about, making sure that we make the choices that are going to maintain some of those critical middle class programs and have a balanced approach. But within that is the second thing. Be honest about the numbers. I can pick on Mitt Romney for a second here, his $5 trillion tax cut, where he says, here's the $5 trillion I'm going to cut. I know you're worried about the deficit, so I'm going to say it's revenue neutral, and I will tell you I will make up for it with $5 trillion in eliminations of write-offs. Well, which ones? I don't want to say.
Could he do it with write-offs?
We'll get to
most
that
people
later.
Say you can't, right?
Well, the only way he could do it is if he got rid of absolutely everyone, including mortgage deduction. Healthcare is the big one. But my point is, we need an honest discussion about the numbers. But the third thing that I really want to point out, we got to get the confidence back in the American people. And the way to do that is to, at least as a starting point, be honest with them about the choices.
Where's President Obama fudging the numbers?
Well, I think the biggest place he's fudging his numbers, and I'll go ahead and say this, is on the tax cuts. I want a more balanced approach, and certainly revenue has to be part of it. And the president has said, okay, we're going to save all of the tax cuts that we've done for the last 12 years for everybody under 250, and we'll just take them off for the people over 250. The problem with that is 80%+ of the tax cuts from the Bush tax cuts go to people making less than 250. It's going to be really hard to rewrite that tax code and say, if you're under 250, we're going to keep every cut we've given to you in the last 14 years. I just think that's going to be difficult if you want to then also preserve Medicare and Social Security, preserve education, preserve the infrastructure. I think those numbers don't quite add up.
Social Security payroll tax cut, should that be allowed to expire?
Yes, absolutely. I wasn't a huge fan of it in the first place. We've done a lot of different tax cuts. We've got a massive deficit, to do that. And furthermore, it's money that comes out of Social Security, which is a critical program to preserve. Yeah, it's been there for 2 years. It was meant to be 1 year temporary. It's time to let it go.
Jim Postma, you're running in part on the question of Social Security, and you talk about the Social Security Investment Trust Act of 2012. How would that save the system and help people retire?
Okay. Yeah, this is Jim Postma, and the way it will save the system is because, well, the problem with our government right now is that government doesn't make any money. It's merely transferring money from the payroll taxes and the deductions to the people who are retired. So that when you go to retire, there won't be very much money left there. Now it's not a great idea. I'm on retirement. Now I'm getting $17,000 a year. If we took the money that is going to transfer payments right now and invested it in this new Social Security Investment Trust, it would pay at a normal rate of return, then that money would be available to the person when he retires, and it would amount to about $1 million for the average person, so that when he retires, he'll be able to retire on 100% pension. Right now, most of the people I talk to that are young don't really think they're going to get anything out of this system at all. But besides providing for the retirement of the people, all that money, $1 trillion a year, will be going into American business, boosting business. See, we don't really have a tax problem right now. All the talk is about taxes. We have a revenue problem. The revenue, the economy is down so far because of the current policies that the revenue is coming in low, and it doesn't matter what you do about taxes or how you split it up, you're still not going to cover the deficit. And it's a useless argument, because there just isn't enough money in the economy right now. So the first thing we need to do is get the economy going again to avoid the fiscal cliff and to get the that's about it. And I think that the money going into the Social Security Investment Trust being invested in American business, and it's going to be invested in companies like right here in this area, in Microsoft and Boeing and all the other companies that make the American economy great. And we're going to let the wealth managers of this country manage all that money, so that the working person right now doesn't really have a chance to save any money. We've got three classes in this country. We've got the poor class that are on welfare. We've got the working class that's desperately trying to save some money and can't, and we got the rich people who invest money. Well, what I'm proposing here is to make the working class the investment class, and now they will be able to be riding around on the boats when they retire instead of just the rich. So this will make everybody wealthy. And that the reason for that is because, well, it's like Albert Einstein said, that compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world, that if you invest your money, even at a low rate of return, for a long enough period of time, it really builds up.
What do you do with people who are only making $15,000 a year or $20,000 a year, and they're putting aside their 12%? I think that was what you're having people put aside, 12%, and you're projecting a 5% growth in the investment over time. Those people end up with about $17,000, maybe $20,000, $27,000, depending on what they're making. Is that enough money?
The money you put into the system will about triple. So, like, I took the average person at $50,000, will put $240,000 into it, and quadruple. Actually, that should reach close to $1 billion, depending upon the rate of return.
What about all the people? What about the people below average?
A third of that.
What about the people below that average? Because you're talking about you get out what you put in, right?
Yeah, plus interest and dividends. Exactly.
So, people who make less than that will get less back than the person making $50,000. Somebody making $25,000 for 40 years will get half that, what you're talking about. Is that enough?
No, it probably isn't. And so that's why I'm not proposing with this reform to change any of the existing laws or any existing taxes or anything else, because it stands by itself. So that if you don't have enough money in your investment account, you will retain the current benefits. So if you don't have enough money to retire on, you'll still get the minimum Social Security benefits. That amounts to about $20,000 a year right now.
And if I might, I think the problem with that is investments, yes, if they are in fact earning interest, that's a positive thing. But I think we would have all learned from 2008 that it doesn't always go up. It does, when you're investing in U.S. companies, occasionally go down. And that's the reason that Social Security was set up. It's not – Social Security was never meant to be the sole source of your retirement. It was meant to be the one piece that was a guaranteed return. You can make investments elsewhere, but that's the way you balance and manage risk. If you now take all of it and expose it to risk, it can go the other way, and you can not get 5% a year.
Well,
you can not get 1% a year.
Don't necessarily invest.
Let him finish, Jim, and I'll let you
I'm sorry. You can lose all of it.
Wealth managers invest money in lots of different places.
Like real estate.
So, Well, I'm proposing that we use the wealth managers of this country. And the reason the people are rich is because they have these wealth managers, and they don't always ride the stock market up and down. There's other alternatives. But we definitely want to keep the money in this country invested here,
overseas. What about that idea, though, Adam Smith? I mean, we do have wealth managers who do assume that we'll get about 8% return, if you're lucky, 5% otherwise, over time. 40 years is a long time. If somebody's working, why not invest and make the workers owners in the company?
That's fine. And we've got all kinds of different plans. We've got IRAs. We've got thrift savings plans. We have a variety of different things that give people the option to invest that money, depending on your employer. Sometimes they contribute to that, you know, a guaranteed contribution plan. But look, the problem is exactly what I just described. Yes, you know, as Jim said, some investment managers do well. Some don't. You know, you look at the loss of wealth in 2008 that happened in real estate and everything else. Imagine if everything was in that, if there was no Social Security, if there was no guaranteed benefit, if you were basically at the mercy of your return and you happened to retire right at the end of one of those bubbles bursting. That's, you know, that's the reason for Social Security. What Jim is basically proposing is privatizing Social Security.
Wasn't he saying that there'd be a minimum? There'd be a floor of 20,000 if it did go down, if you fell below poverty.
Yeah. Well, again, if we've invested and lost all of this money, it then makes it very, very hard to maintain that floor. Makes the program very, very expensive if the money isn't there.
All right. Let me ask you a different question, Jim Postma. You said that we got to get the economy going again. What policies are keeping the economy from moving forward right now?
Well, I just talked to a rug dealer last night buying some carpets for him. He says he's quitting because he cannot afford to operate right now with all the regulations and the taxes and the coming fiscal cliff, you know, small business coming into a fiscal cliff because of this health care law. That's gonna drive a lot of small business out of business. I've got a friend running a small TV company, and his medical care, his insurance doubled since the health care law was passed because, well, the rates have gone up. And the reason, of course, one of the reasons is because of this no prior conditions thing. Well, why should people buy, especially young people, buy health insurance if they can get health insurance when they get sick? They can't be refused for prior conditions. Well, so, of course, the insurance companies have to increase the rates dramatically, and they have. They've gone up. They've almost doubled in some cases because of this health care law. Now, the first thing we need to do is to get rid of that law. And if you're a senior, you better be thinking about getting out of it because the not only are your benefits are being cut, they're being rationed, they're being restricted, the doctors are fleeing the system, and this is making it very difficult for small business to operate, so much so that the fast food companies are getting an exception from Obamacare because they'll go out of business if they have to comply with it. McDonald's and Arby's and Jack in the Box and all those companies are going off it. Another thing that's happening is that they'll hire more temporary employees instead of permanent employees. The way the law reads now, if you hire 50 employees, you have to comply with this. Well, but that's permanent employees, so there's more and more people are going on temporary work and fewer are going on permanent work, so they will not get any benefits at all.
This is that how really the health care law is working, according to you, Adam Smith?
Well, the biggest thing that's wrong with
wrong with what he said about
that? Well, the biggest thing he's wrong about is health care inflation. Health care inflation has been a devastating problem for years, okay, long before health care reform was passed. But all of the national studies show that it is actually less now than it was before the law was passed. What Jim is just describing has been happening to small businesses for years as they've tried to wrestle with the costs of high health care. The only hope we have for getting health care costs under control is, number one, Jim did describe one thing. Everybody has to be covered. That's why the individual mandate was so important. If there is no individual mandate, Jim is right. You know, basically, if you can bounce on and off of health care whenever you want to, it doesn't work. Everybody's got to be in the pool. That's something that healthcare reform actually helps, doesn't hurt. So he's wrong about that piece of it. And the second thing is you do have to have aggressive cost control mechanisms in there. But this is true. Blaming everything that has happened in healthcare and healthcare reform is dead wrong. The problems that have been described were there before. Businesses were facing enormous increases in costs. What the Affordable Care Act does, it gives us a chance to get that under control. Now, if it's not implemented well, then we're going to have a heck of a time making this work. There's a lot more work to be done, but it at least gives us a chance to get to a better healthcare system than the one we had that was killing us before.
If there's a President Romney, you'll be in the minority in the House most likely again. What do you do to try to, for example, to get healthcare
moving forward when the president, President Romney, says he'll veto it. He'll repeal it.
Yeah, well, these are the two big issues that we're facing. And I will agree. I think one of the biggest problems with our economy right now is massive uncertainty. The best thing Congress could do, get a 10-year plan on what's our tax policy going to be, what's our spending policy going to be, get that out of the way instead of continually kicking the can down the road. And I want to make it clear, that's the most important thing we have to do between now and January 2nd. Get that plan in place. Don't let all the taxes expire. Don't let sequestration happen. And the second thing is, yes, have the health care law, something that people can depend on. Because I think a lot of the uncertainty is exactly what you just described. Well, who's going to be president? Is it going to be there or not? Now, if there's a President Romney in a Republican Congress, you know, I'll do my best, as I always do, to work with them, but it's going to be difficult.
Is there a plan in place, the Bowles Commission? Is there a plan in place that could be brought out between November and January?
Absolutely. We've been talking about it for a while. You've got Simpson Bowles. You also have the Gang of Six and the Senate that came up with a plan about a year ago. Now, you know, no one supports 100% of all those details, but the basic framework for how to reform our tax code and how to reform our spending policies to put us on a more fiscally sustainable path is there. It's just that it's not politically popular. So we're going to have to work together in a bipartisan way to get that done.
All right. Jim Postma, I appreciate you trying to get here. I'm sorry you got stuck in traffic. Jim Postma is a rocket scientist, aviation engineer, Republican candidate for Congress in the 9th. Adam Smith is the Democratic congressman from Washington State's 9th District, seeking re-election. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:31. I'm Andy Hurst. Coming up next, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Timothy Egan. His latest book tells the fascinating story of photographer Edward Curtis, who embarked on a huge project in 1900 to document the surviving Indian tribes across the U.S. Tim Egan joins us next.
Support for KUOW comes from Lakeside School, a diverse educational community, grades 5 through 12, committed to contributing to a global society. Families can learn more at open houses for middle school November 5th or upper school November 4th. Details at lakesideschool.org.
Clouds and showers in Seattle, 55 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting clouds and rain, heavy at times all day today, the high getting up to 56. Clouds and showers expected tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low 53, tomorrow's high reaching 57.
Support for KUOW comes from Clipper Vacations. Clipper offers daily trips to Victoria, BC, along with many other Northwest getaways. More information available at clippervacations.com, your Pacific Northwest travel experts.
Nevermore.
I'm Neil Gaiman, and this week I'm looking forward to huddling with you around the campfire to listen to the work of Edgar Allan Poe on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
And that comes your way tonight at 10 o'clock.
All right, now let's turn to how this country has developed. Chances are you've seen the works of Edward Curtis, possibly maybe not even realizing it. His are iconic, definitive photographic images of Native Americans as the 19th century turned into the 20th century. Author and New York Times journalist Timothy Egan has been looking into Edward Curtis's life, and he's written a book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, who was he?
Well, you know, if you lived in Seattle 110 years ago, there was no better known Seattleite than Edward Curtis. You picked up your newspaper on a Sunday and there was a two-page spread, Curtis back from Southwest where he documents snake dance. You know, he was this sort of this returning conqueror. Curtis proves elites in East Coast wrong by showing that Apache, quote, do have religion, because the conventional wisdom was they didn't have any religion. They were a godless people. Curtis returns from summer weekend with President You know, he was a consort of Teddy Roosevelt. So he was a very well-known guy, not just for his photographs, for his sort of flash and debonair and what he was trying to, and this, the audacity of what he was trying to do, which was document as many North American Indian tribes as then existed that still live somewhat by the old ways.
How did he come to that audacious idea?
You know, first it's important, Steve, to understand the man. He had a sixth grade education. He lived in a homestead shack across Puget Sound, what is now Port Orchard. A few years after he leaves the homestead shack, he's taking pictures of the elite of Seattle. So he's a very ambitious guy, 6'2", very good looking, very athletic, a mountaineer, pioneer climber on Mount Hood, led the Mazamas up Hood and Mount Rainier. And the women were required to wear bloomers was one of the things I found when he led more women to the summit of Rainier than anyone had ever done. But in very short time, he went from this absolute nobody guy, literally foraging for berries and clams, to being the premier portrait photographer in the United States. And then he takes the leap that for which he's famous. I'm sorry.
Just real quick, he's laid up with an injury because he's doing some logging, right?
Right. His dream in life was to own this little sawmill, you know, in Port Orchard.
How old is he at this point?
He's like 21, right. And he has a terrible accident rolling one of these logs and falls and mangles his back and spends almost a year horizontal on his back with his widowed mother and four kids at home. And this sort of neighbor girl comes by who he ultimately marries, this beautiful teenage girl. But it's while he's on his back that he starts to observe the world, the outside world, and light and prisms of light and how it changes, and starts fiddling with this camera that his old man, the preacher, had brought home from the Civil War.
Just the lens.
Right, exactly. You did read the book. Very good. Good attention to detail.
Like Curtis.
That's not even in your cheat notes either. I applaud you for that. Just the lens, which he built into a camera. He later buys a 14x17. It's important to understand how he took his pictures too. Glass plate negatives are these big, cumbrous things that he schlepped around, whether it was in Mount Rainier or in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. He puts it into a 14x17 view camera, takes an image on that glass, then schleps the glass back to Seattle, where it later will be projected onto metal.
Yeah, it's an amazing technology. And Curtis saw it as an art form, in part because of how he had to interact with the image.
Exactly. And he's a fusion of two people. He started as an artist. That's why he was so famous as a portrait photographer, that he could get something out of a person. They would look at a portrait and say, my God, you captured something I never thought was there. Even if the guy is just a banker with three chins, he was able to find some. I looked at these pictures at the Rainier Club of all these bankers with three chins because he earned his living down there for a while. That's how he paid his rent when his wife kicked him out. But so that artist sensibility he brings to this documentarian sensibility, which is, oh my God, the continent's original people are disappearing, and I want to capture them before they go.
All right. There's the very famous picture of Princess Angeline. Was that wasn't his very first Native American picture, was it?
It actually was.
It was his first?
He said in his dying years, in his 80s, when he's telling his life story to the Seattle librarian in a series of just really interesting notes back and forth, he paid her $1 for the sitting, and this is what's interesting about that. Seattle will soon become the biggest city in the world named for a Native American, but they passed an ordinance making it illegal for a Native American to live within the city limits. They let Princess Angeline, the last surviving child of Chief Seattle, for whom the city is named, live and hang around in this tiny little shack because she's sort of a validation that their way of life is superior to this one they've just pushed out. I mean, they've got this gorgeous city. They can't believe their good fate without even having an Indian war over it. And they let this one sad little Indian, the daughter of Chief Seattle, live in this shack down on the waterfront downtown. She sells clams door to door and she does people's laundry. Curtis finds her and he sees this image in his mind of authenticity, of original Seattle, of nature and person fused. And that becomes his first picture, Princess Angeline. He shoots it in 1896.
Tim Egan is our guest. He's written Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, the epic life and immortal photographs of Edward Curtis. Tim Egan's going to be, you're going to be all over the place. When are you next? You're going to be Thursday, November 8th at the Tacoma Public Library.
But tonight at Town Hall.
And tonight at Town Hall.
7:30.
At 7:30. Let me take a break, and then I want to come back and talk about that authenticity notion. This is Weekday.
Clouds and showers, 55 degrees in the University District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today. The high is sneaking up to 56. It's going to be cloudy and rainy tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low, 53. Tomorrow's high, reaching 57.
Support for KUOW comes from PacMed's 9 neighborhood locations. Same-day screening mammogram appointments are available at the Beacon Hill and Canyon Park clinics. Hours of operation available at pacmed.org or at 1-888-4-PACMED.
So you guys don't have an inkling of what you're about to see if we go in there.
No.
But it's a, you know, privileged area.
Is this the thing about which we spoke?
Oh. There was something on the faces. Oh,
holy moly.
They fill the eye sockets.
Oh my God, there's like a...
They puff out the lips.
Oh, man. On the next Radiolab.
A large, ugly growth.
Tumors.
Famous tumors on the next Radiolab.
And the next Radiolab comes your way Friday night at 7 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 9:40.
Tim Egan is a Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest book tells the fascinating story of the photographer Edward Curtis. In 1900, Curtis set himself the task of photographing Native Americans from across North America in a project that turned into a lifelong vocation, obsession, a project that worked on his health and his mind and his family, but in the end, he finished it in 20 volumes. We'll get to that in a minute about how he sold those. But mm-hmm. let's talk about authenticity.
Sure.
Princess Evangeline, Angeline, mm-hmm. if you want to change your name. That picture, he got a few pictures of her.
16.
Page 16.
Page 16, yeah.
He got a few pictures of her, but the one that he liked wasn't the first one. He got one that made her look a little, I don't know, I think you wrote that she looked a little nicer.
Right, right. He wanted to capture, as I said, that withering glare, that screw you look, because she was carrying rocks around in her dress because the little boys, the little Denny kids and stuff were all throwing rocks at her. They called her the hag, the shrew, the old crone. They would wait after school, throw rocks at her. And so she carried rocks as well. He knew that. He always understood context before he took his picture. So he wanted to get that look of, you've taken everything from me, but I've still got something.
Right, so
same with Chief Joseph.
You yes. knew I was going to Chief Joseph. You knew I was going there. So
chapter two at the end of chapter.
How does that one relate to the Chief Joseph picture? Because Chief Joseph picture three, is more created.
Right. Well, no, he shoots two versions of Chief Joseph. One is with a headdress, one is without. End of chapter three is where the picture is. Oops.
No, that's right.
Right, right.
You see me jumping through the book.
Yeah,
you just
yeah.
go ahead.
Okay. He shoots two pictures of Chief Joseph in his studio. Again, let's understand context. It's 1903. Joseph will be dead within a year. He's living as a virtual prisoner of war on a reservation in Colville. And the people of Seattle bring him over to go to a Husky game. They parade him around at this football game, and they write these incredibly patronizing story. Indian watches football game, grunts. They said, what did you think of a football game? He said, I saw a lot of white people almost hurt each other. So Curtis understands that Joseph is here because he wants to get his homeland back. He's going to give a speech before a big crowd in his native language, and he wants to get his homeland back. That's why he's doing it. And so when he sits him down to take the picture, he alone understands the plight of the Nez Perce. He's researched the history. He's gone to Eastern Washington. And so the context is of this guy who's portrayed as this Indian Napoleon, but actually is more of a wise person, a person who understood, you know, that he'd lost everything and still wanted to get it back.
So the rap on Curtis has been Curtis exploited the natives. This is the most egregious rap. He exploited the natives. He forced them to wear costumes that they were no longer wearing. And he paid them in order to get sales
yeah.
of these pictures.
Well, first of all, that rap doesn't come from the natives themselves. They appreciate what Curtis did. And I went to almost every reservation that Curtis went to. And believe me, this guy is incredibly appreciated. His pictures are everywhere. More importantly, Steve, he captured audio recordings, more than 10,000 different wax cylinder recordings of songs and language that otherwise would have left the planet. So they appreciate him for preserving their culture at a time when it was illegal to preserve that culture. I mean, we'd passed laws making it illegal for them to do these worships. Now, the rap on him, he never denied. This is revisionism. He never, ever denied in any contemporary essay that he paid people. He spent a lot of time with them, and he wanted to pay them for their time. He was a portrait artist taking portraits, so he paid his subjects. He also would say sometimes, if he arrived in a reservation, he'd spent months there, and he would sometimes spend years before he would take a picture just to get it right. do you have any of the clothes that your father wore? They would have overalls on, or they would have, stiff collared dress shirts. And he'd say, do you have any headdresses? Do you have any buckskin? And they'd say, well, yes, we do back here. And he said, well, that's what I'd like to shoot, is the picture that shows you as your father's people were. And then he asked many of them, which would you prefer, a modern clothes or the clothes of your grandfather? And invariably, except for near the end, when he got to the Comanche, where you'll see pictures with dress shirts and ties, they chose those things. So he never this was a false thing. Also, if you went to Scotland tomorrow and went around taking a photographic, epic of the clans of Scotland, and you asked somebody to put on a kilt, that's what he did, a family kilt. These are family clothing items that he asked people to wear for his portrait.
How do you view these pictures today? What are they?
I love, and I think most people agree with me on this, the portraits more than the sort of, pictures of people reenacting a battle or grazing their horses by the water or doing a ritual, a dance. The portraits themselves, and this is what the native people say, they show a humanity in the faces. And this is what was so revolutionary about Seattle's Edward Curtis was he was the first person to really show human beings in these faces. They were stick figures. The idea was you were either noble savage or cigar store Indians. And he showed human beings in the faces. They laugh. They're smug. They, look away, in really awful gazes. They do, especially near the end when he goes to the north and finds people living without missionary influences. They're all smiling and laughing in those pictures.
Curtis did not like the missionaries or the Indian agents, the government agents.
His worst, he had two enemies. One was time itself because it was robbing him of these subjects. They were dying at a rather, 235,000 natives. That's what the census counted in all the United States in 1900, down from 20 million. His other enemies were the missionaries, because if he got to a reservation, say the Blackfeet in Montana, and he saw the crucifix in the church, he knew he was doomed. Because Indian policy then was to take little kids out of the tribes, put them into these boarding schools, and scrub the Indian out of them, send them back with haircuts, new clothes, and new religion. And they said, this isn't my line, they said, we want to wash the Indian out of them. So he finally, near the end of his life, gets to the far north in 1927, north of the Arctic Circle, and he finds no missionaries at all. And he finds happy people, prosperous people, living, in his mind, authentically.
I love the picture of that Nunavik woman.
I do, too.
He takes it at the very end. Now, what about, sorry, so here's this, this is one of some of his first pictures, the Piegan Dandy, mm-hmm. It's called. This is from Montana. How does this guy compare, this portrait of this guy, compare to, what was the name of the writer who was writing all those dime novels? May?
Well, yeah, Carl May, it's pronounced.
Carl May.
It was a German writer who wrote incredibly popular novels about Indians having never seen an Indian. And that was very common. When Curtis went back to the Smithsonian and spoke to their Indian experts, they said the Indians have no religion. They said, how do you know? He goes, well, we've never been there, but we've been told that they have no religion. Most people had never experienced it. He went full immersion for 30 years. He became a member of the Snake Dance Society in Hopi land in Arizona. Took him 10 years until he could go into the pit and handle the snakes himself so he could understand what a snake dance warrior is. So unlike Carl May, who wrote about Indians from Germany, Curtis photographed Indians after spending months, years, decades with them. He understood the culture.
He understood
the myth.
You read his letters. You read his short biography that he wrote, autobiography that he wrote. You read lots of letters, and mm-hmm. people were asking him questions after he'd fallen into obscurity for 20 years before he died. People were finding him and writing him letters. Mm-hmm. What drove him? What was his motivation? I mean, 30 years to work on this project, to get 20 volumes. And
it broke him, too. As you mentioned, it cost him his marriage. It cost him, he lost his copyright to what is arguably the greatest book project ever done by a single American. It's compared to John James Audubon's Birds of America. It was compared to the King James Bible. The thing sold for $3,000 in 1910 to get a single volume. So, I mean, this was a huge, huge achievement just in terms of bookmaking. And put aside the context, the myths, the recordings, the pictures, just the achievement of the technology of the bookmaking, not to mention the film he did as well, which was Breakthrough, first real Native documentary film.
In the land of the Wiccanis.
Yeah, using an all-Native cast on location. No one had ever done that. Indians were Italians with face paint. So what drove him? He was a poor kid. He had the insecurity of self-made men. No, they don't really trust me. The bastards don't understand me. The Smithsonian, the elites back east, the universities were always after him. They didn't think. In fact, his anthropology has really held up, particularly in the section on the Crow in Montana, which is used as a field study right now. It's the best thing ever done on the Crow because he spent so much time there. And his best friend, who was later murdered, this Crow translator, really helped him with the Crow. Upshaw was the guy's name, the guy who was educated at the Indian school and came back and was conflicted. So, but what drove him? I think it. My conclusion, having read all the stuff, is that it's no more complex than what drives any great artist or writer. He wanted to do something lasting and immortal. He said all the time to his buddy Ed Meany, after whom many Meany sites in the University of Washington are named. That Meany was his closest friend and the person who understood Indians as much as he did. He said of his subjects, "I simply want to make them live forever." And he wanted, in that sense, his own immortality. He wanted to do something great and lasting. And sometimes he would just feel like nobody appreciated him, and he'd be in a hotel room in New York, and Meany would write him, you know, "You'll be long dead, but people will be reading about you. People will be looking at your pictures. You will outlive this."
You know, people say he created museum pieces, that he froze them in time. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I think he did. I think that was his goal, too, because the time was slipping away. Now, as the authenticity, whatever you want to call it, of the original tribe started to slip, by the time Curtis is in Oklahoma in the 1920s, which is the designated Indian territory for a long time, we dumped all the tribes from the east there after the Indian Removal Act forced all Indians to move east of the Mississippi. He doesn't find anyone living in the old ways. They're all, you know, in overalls and dress shirts and short hair. What does he shoot? Short hair, overalls. There's a picture of a Comanche. They were the Lord of the Plains. Everyone feared the Comanche. That's Quinault Parker's tribe. They wailed on the Texas Rangers. They wailed on the Apache. They ruled a whole swath of the Southern Plains. And now they're living in a postage stamp sized reservation. And what does he shoot? He shoots a picture of a guy with short hair and a tie. So to go back to the frozen in time, he froze the time that was going on. I mean, by the time he's in the 20s, he's freezing that time there.
You say something pretty funny was that though Curtis disappeared from consciousness, Native Americans didn't. And in part, they had Curtis's, the work he had done on capturing songs and writing down the songs and the recordings, which is amazing. He carried that recorder with him in the 1900s.
That's one of the things that blew me away about Curtis, and I don't think most people know, is he didn't just write captions for these pictures. There are 2,200 pages of text in the 20 volumes of his magnum opus, The North American Indian. And in those 2,200 pages are long, detailed stories of creation myths, of diet, of who they fought and who they loved, stories of clans and bands and tribes that no one had researched before, no one had researched with such exhaustive detail. And then those recordings. You can hear now some of the songs that Curtis recorded, and there's no substitute for the actual audio.
You've heard them?
Oh, yes. They're just incredible. They're extraordinary. And then he did a movie with an all-Native cast, too, by the way, as I mentioned.
Which, as you say, was restored at some point.
And now it's hailed as a pioneer breakthrough that it was.
I just real quick before I'm out of time. So to get these volumes printed and published, to get some support for his work, which the story I understand, he doesn't get any money for it. He goes to J.P. Morgan.
Right.
He gets some support from J.P. Morgan, but he has to sell basically subscriptions to rich people.
Right. So Curtis his portrait business is not supporting his great idea. So he ends up going hand to hat to all these rich people. Roosevelt and E.H. Harriman have introduced him to some of them. And he's not getting much money. He finally ends up with the richest banker in the United States, J.P. Morgan, who's the de facto, you know, Federal Reserve when we didn't have a Federal Reserve. And Morgan grants him $75,000 over 5 years, which is enough to fund his field staff, his translators. Remember, he has up to 30 people on his payroll at any one time. It's not just this guy going around alone.
Right. He has people helping him write it.
Right,
write great it, writers
edit
working it, with
technicians. But Curtis, two things. Curtis works for free, which breaks him. And ultimately, he ends up to mortgage this thing. Morgan gives him $2.5 million, and Curtis gives up his copyright. So he owns nothing in 1930 when he's done with the last volume.
And then the Depression comes, and Morgan, just what happened? What does Morgan do with that?
Well, they sell the complete collection of Edward S. Curtis, which there then was about 50 of these individual volumes. Keep in mind, one volume can go for almost $2 million today. The 50 of them, all the copper plates, all the recordings, they sell it to this Boston bookseller for $1,000. And this guy, Laureate was his name, dies shortly thereafter, like a year after purchasing it, and it rots in a basement until the 1970s.
It's a great story. I like it. And and you were in the Rainier Club, and you said all these pictures that are in the Rainier Club, a lot of them are done by Curtis to sort of pay his dues, including the portrait of Teddy Roosevelt's hanging there?
Yes. The Rainier Club has become, by default, one of the great Curtis museums in the world. Why? Because when Curtis's marriage broke up and his wife kicked him out, he moved into the Rainier Club. I saw the little bunk upstairs, the little room where he stayed. So while Curtis is housing in the Rainier Club, you know, more than 10 years, he tells everyone, you can meet me at the Rainier Club. He has to pay his rent. How does he pay his rent? He gives up some of his masterpieces, including the Roosevelt portrait, which Curtis took while summering at the summer White House at Sagamore Hill. Roosevelt later said it was the best picture anyone ever took of him, and he uses it in his autobiography as the main picture. It shows a soft Roosevelt, no big teeth, no warrior. It shows a more thoughtful Roosevelt.
Yes.
That's what the ability that Curtis had. He could find a side to a person that others could not.
One of the great things about it is that, you know, you can Google Curtis photographs, and there's so many on the web to look at, and there's a lot in this book as well. Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis, written by Pulitzer Prize winner Tim Egan, who will be at the town hall tonight. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate
this is Weekday. Let's get a quick weather and a hike from Michael Fagan. We're going to get a little more update, Michael, on the big storm hitting the East Coast and also hitting the concerns for floods here. I was wondering, where do you send people when it's raining on a hike?
Well, we don't. We're telling you to stay home. Today in the city, we're looking at 1 to 2 inches of rain. Many locations already had a half inch. Then on Wednesday, another inch of rain. So it's really best just to stay home today, and the next break in weather will actually be Friday. We're actually looking at a dry day, and on any of these hikes, we suggest check with the ranger station, especially in the winter time. There could be road issues and so forth. I checked with the ranger this morning, and all systems are go on Packwood Lake, just south of Mount Rainier, just east of the town of Packwood. One of the highlights now, there's no snow on the trail nor on the road. It's usually a good hike, rain or shine, but again, not today or Wednesday, just too much heavy rain. It's not too bad in mileage, 10 miles round trip, only 600-foot gain. And on Friday, you might get lucky and get a view of Mount Rainier, Johnson Peak. So it's a real nice hike. There's Old Guard Station. It was built in 1910 right by the lake. And you need your forest pass and Green Trails Map 302.
Today, stay inside, look at pictures of the mountains, look at Edward Curtis's pictures of life in the 1900s, and stay dry.
Stay dry, stay in, and work hard. How's that?
That's very good. Your bosses around the world will like you this time.
Okay, yeah, I know they get mad at me some other days, but not today.
Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather, LLC. He helps people who are heading out into the wilderness figure out what the weather's going to be like all around the world. His blog, Fagan's Weather World, suggests good hikes to match the week's weather forecast. We have a link to it and more information at KUOW.org. Michael, thanks a lot.
You bet. Bye.
Bye.
And now, the sound of the day.
So before pumpkin picking at the Scandia Pumpkin Patch in Paulsbo on Sunday, the Rozak family, mom, dad, two teenagers, an exchange student from Portugal, crossed the road to Scandia Creek to watch the salmon making their way upstream. It's a tiny creek, and the water level is so low that the salmon bodies were often half exposed as they made their way. The salmon were gathering in very small pools. We're making valiant attempts to get over a very tiny waterfall. Rozak family says the sight was stunning. Thank you for sending that sound and the video to us, which put up on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. What sounds are you hearing? What emblematic images and acoustics of the Northwest can you record for us? Or your life around these images, this world? Record 30 seconds, send it to us along with the story behind it, just like that. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. We're going to get a storm update after the news from National Public Radio. We're also going to talk about climate change and that climate change silence that's been coming from both presidential campaigns, and talk a little bit about what policies might just bridge the two sides, if that's possible. And we'll garden. Stay with us.
Good morning. It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Rick Steves Europe, presenting a day of travel classes at the Europe Through the Back Door Travel Festival in downtown Edmonds, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. in downtown Edmonds, Saturday, November 3rd. More information at ricksteves.com.
Today, millions woke up to the effects of sand.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.